Macro Trading Floor.
With me, Alfonso Peccatiello, founder of the Macro Compass and former head of investments at a large European bank.
And I am Brent Donnelly, president of Spectrum Markets. I've been a portfolio manager, day trader, and market maker at the biggest commercial and investment banks in the United States. I'm also the author of Alpha Trader and The Art of Currency Trading. If you want to know what's going on in markets and where they're going, you found the right podcast.
Hey, everybody. Alf here. Welcome back to the Macro Trading Floor. Hey, Brent, how are you doing?
Hey, Alf, I'm good. It's an interesting time. We're kind of on the cusp of maybe a little move out of this boring low volatility regime.
I had a promise that we would have a bold guest this week. The bold guest is coming next week, but still two bold guys running the podcast. So not much has changed here. One thing has changed, that we have a Fed meeting next week, and the market seems to have changed its tune a tiny bit, right? We have had the CPI print, the PPI print just today. We're recording on Thursday, the 14th of March. And Brent, I think the bond market is waking up a bit.
Yeah, so there's two things kind of going on. You can look at CPI, and it's very easy to slice and dice and find aspects of it that you can poo-poo. Like, it was strong, but you can say, oh, it's just auto insurance, it's just transportation services. And that's fine. I mean, there's always something, right, that's driving it. But you can say that those things are temporary and this and that. And then we got PPI a little bit strong as well. But I think forgetting about that argument of the details and the components of CPI that just came out, if you look forward, headline inflation is probably going higher for now because oil's making new highs, gas prices, 6-month highs today, 7-month highs in RBOB, real rates are rising again. So we've been in this regime of, so essentially Waller teed up the March cut last November, right? And then they slowly moved it back. Now the ECB and the Fed are teeing up the June cut, but there always seems to be a cut 3 to 4 months away and they just keep on rolling it. And so to me, the data is really in control, not the central banks. And the data is going to start heating up a little bit. Like we're seeing not, I wouldn't say broad and aggressive reacceleration, but we are seeing some reacceleration in specifically in oil and gas, I think is probably the most important, obviously, for headline. And it points to the idea that maybe the Fed turned dovish a little bit too early and now they're backpedaling. And yeah, they don't care if shitcoins are rallying 1,000%, but they definitely care if oil's rallying and gasoline prices are at 7-month highs. So I think we're on the cusp of maybe moving away from a very low economic volatility and a low bond market volatility regime into something that might be a little bit more interesting.
Well, the Elizabeth Warren coin was up 9,000% last Saturday. I'm not sure whether it matters for the Fed. I don't think so. So the CPI came in and it basically showed that January wasn't only a statistical aberration, right? I mean, now you have also February, which is not a price resetty kind of thing. It's actually February. So it's free of seasonality much more than January is. And now if you look at the core CPI and then the core PPI and I run my models into what does that mean for core PCE, which is the Fed, pretty much the Fed target, one can say, that right. Means that it's reaccelerating, like the 3-month and the 6-month annualized measures of that should be in the 3% realm. Now, you know, when your main inflation target was trending at about 2% for 2 to 3 months, you felt very good. And I think that's why Waller came to the wire and said, well, you know, we're doing March at the end of the day. But now after you have two data points pushing your annualized trend back to 3%, how comfortable are you that you're really going back to 2? Maybe your level of confidence has gone down quite a lot. For me, Brent, the most important thing is that this is maybe another proof for some Fed members that policy is less structurally tight than they think it was. So what that means is the neutral rate would have to be moved higher. So the level at which the Federal Reserve thinks the US economy can run smoothly, right now they think it's 2.5% nominal. So they said, yeah, we raised at 5.25. That's way higher than our 2.5 neutral. That means policy is very, very tight. But data has been proving them kind of wrong for now a few quarters in a row. So while it still could be that the neutral rate is 2.5, there might be some pressure on them to try and move this neutral rate higher. So to basically say, yeah, we'll cut a couple of times these years, maybe 3. But then in 2025, we're not going to follow up with 4 cuts. And then in 2026, with another 4 cuts. That's not how it works. We're going to do a few of them, and then we're going to just pause, which is what they did in 1995, actually, when the last time that we saw a soft landing. I think this is something the market is now adjusting to. If you see the front end of bond markets, slowly it's getting there, but I'm not sure it's fully there if they really just dot plot like that.
And real rates are almost back to 2% again. So today specifically, we're seeing a dollar rally on that because people get a little bit uncomfortable. I think there's a psychological element to 2% real rates. And as you said, if they think that our star or the neutral rate or whatever, if they thought it was 2.5 and Fed funds is above 5 and everything is specking like 2021 style, then there's no way that they're going to have 100% faith that they're correct and that they can cut. So what do you think that means for the dots next week?
Okay, so I think that there are good odds that they will move the median dots for 2024 to 2 cuts versus 3 that are shown now. But the most important part for me will be what they do with the 2025 dots and with the long run dot, because that tells me what's their stance on the long run neutral rate, right? Apart from what they do this year, this will tell me how much they think they should do going forward, more structurally. And the 2025 dots are 4 cuts. That's quite robust in this type of environment. In 1995, the Fed cut only 3 times, like literally 3 times, and then they didn't cut anymore for 2.5 years. So it was a long pause with only 3 cuts. And I'm not arguing they should do the same, but there is a chance that the market probabilistic assessment of what the Fed will do could shift a bit more towards 1995 style, okay? So I think the long run dot and the 2025 dots will be very important in signaling what the Fed wants to do. What type of cutting cycle do they want? Do they want like a slow and prolonged one, like the one they were embarking in 2019 before the pandemic hit in early 2020? Or do they want a few insurance cuts basically to go in 2024 and then basically stop? Because if they want this type of pricing into the market, then the market isn't there yet, not nearly there yet. The market is still pricing about 3 cuts this year, another 4 next year, and 1 additional more in 2026. So if they go with a more higher neutral rate pricing, I think it could still be a hawkish surprise on market from here.
And just to use your imagination, because like I always feel like everyone has their base case and kind of like the likely paths of what's going to happen. I'm just going way off here, but do you think there's a world where oil goes to 100 and the Fed is hiking in December of this year? Is that possible? Like, should that be on the bingo card, or is that just crazy talk?
I think it could be on the bingo card. I think the option market that I track is pricing decent probabilities for that tail. So we are about 15, 17, 20% for this kind of scenario.
Oh, really? Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay, I didn't know that.
I can refresh a sheet right now to try and calculate. The last time I did, it was about 16, 17% of such a probability, right? So it's not a high probability, but it shouldn't be either, Brent. It should be like a tail risk, but it isn't priced at 3%. It's priced at 16 or 17%, right? So it's a bit like I could ask you, hey, Brent, what do you think the bond market should price for cuts in line with the recession in a year from now? Your answer will be low. Like, I don't know. Oh, actually, let me ask. What's your answer? What do you think it's fair to price a year out for cuts in line with the recession in the US? Your own opinion.
If we're in a recession in December of this year, say?
No, in a year from now. So in March of next year.
Oh, March. I mean, 8, 10 cuts.
This is the number of cuts. Now I'm asking you, what's your subjective probability that we should be priced now for that?
Oh, I mean, still pretty high, I think, like 25%. It's a long time from now.
Very interesting, because the bond market is pricing about 12 to 13% now.
Okay.
So the bond market is...
I'm an optimist, but I still think the tail is always going to be pretty decently large.
Yeah, there you go. So basically what you are saying is that the tails are both underpriced by the market, right? I mean, the recession tail is priced low. You think it could be priced a bit higher. The higher for longer tail, your initial tail, right? That was your question.
Yeah.
Probably you also think it should be priced a bit fatter here, and it's priced at like 15% or something along these lines. So the market is basically killing all sort of vol. It's behaving in a regime as if there is no economic uncertainty ahead. There's a very predictable path ahead, and that's how it is behaving now. But maybe it changes, Brent, does it?
Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing to keep an eye on. So if you look at MOVE, which is Harley Bassman's equivalent to the VIX for bond volatility, it's basically at the lows now. So it was much, much, much lower before 2020. But now it made a new regime where it was sort of a new higher plateau since 2021, and we're at the bottom of the range post-COVID. So, I mean, that's consistent with very little tail and extrapolation bias, probably, right? Is like, okay, we've had this soft landing vibe for a long time, and the market's just extrapolating that out. And probably the money is to be made in figuring out when that regime shift comes, whether it's, you know, oil and inflationary reacceleration or the bottom finally falls out of the market. One thing that's interesting on the commodity side is like everything that's financial is flying, right? Like Bitcoin, altcoins, gold, copper, you can still say is kind of a financial commodity. Like it's easy to invest in futures and all that. But then a lot of the real commodities, especially iron ore, iron ore is down 35% this year. So it's an interesting dynamic where there's this tension between the debasement trade and the Fed is too loose and they don't know where neutral is. And that makes you buy financial assets. But then iron ore, which is like a real thing that people actually need to extract in order to build stuff, is trading very, very poorly. And I think that's an interesting dynamic. And that's probably part of why it's really hard to read right now what's going on, because you have the China weakness and sort of global demand is not great. Like if you look at Canada, UK, all those countries, demand isn't that strong, but job markets are strong and financial speculation is as strong as it's almost ever been.
Yeah. It's a lot of dichotomies out there. The bond market vol is interesting because it incarnates together with other things like credit spreads, which I'm going to have a quick chat about right now. Mm-hmm. It incarnates this idea of selling tails, selling optionality, right? You say bond market implied volatility, the move index basically shows mm-hmm. you that it's coming down. People are selling optionality. That's the same thing, right? They're shorting vol, they're selling optionality. And another very common way of shorting vol and selling optionality is buying credit spreads instruments. So especially the high yield spectrum of it. And if I look at today, the high yield, US high yield spread index is at 326 basis points. Now, let me try and see what does it mean on a long-term chart. Oh my God, man, I need to extend the axis to a lot of time to find any time cheaper than that. So 326 basis points, for your information, is equivalent to roughly the tightest levels that we reached in 2019, where it was pretty obvious that inflation wasn't reaccelerating, growth wasn't reaccelerating, the Fed was going to cut rates, the ECB was cutting rates. We were in a super predictable environment, non-recessionary, weak growth, disinflation. So that's like the Goldilocks type of environment. In 2017, where growth was even better, so it's even better Goldilocks than that, credit spreads, high yield in the US reached 300 basis points. So we're very, very close, really, to how tight this stuff can be. The emerging market credit spread index, excluding triple C rated garbage stuff. So let's say the non-purely garbage emerging market credit spread index is at its 96th percentile tight over 10 years. That's what we're talking about. You know, people are just buying credit, and this is another way of selling vol. Why is that? Because you get paid to be in this trade as long as nothing happens. You're pocketing the credit spread and it looks nice as long as the economy holds.
And the thing is, it's March right now and we're not going to get any central bank action now till June. So those trades, I think, do make sense, like long carry, long mex and all that stuff. Even at the tights, a lot of those trades make sense. But I think what you have to do is be, hopefully you know it when you see it, when there's a regime shift. Like right now, it seems like we're shifting to more reacceleration. We had talked earlier about a more aggressive deceleration. But the thing is, these low vol times can last longer than you expect. So I feel like trying to front run the breakout into a different regime can be so expensive. Like trying to front run the low vol to high vol transition is very expensive. It's better to buy vol or to sell things, like to buy credit spreads as they're widening, not to try to buy them to fade them at the tights.
Yeah, but let's try to think like our listeners here probably are right now. What are the signs that we should try and look for a potential change in regime between low vol and high vol, or vice versa? What is that we should look at?
I think industrial commodities, oil, the dots, the Fed language, because at some point they're probably going to have to give up on the 95 model, right? And they're going to say, listen, we have no idea where R-star, I mean, they won't say this, but they'll think, we have no idea where R-star is. we better just stop promising cuts because we just don't know. And I think it'll come through the same stuff that accelerated in 21, right? Oil, commodities, housing probably as well. So to me, that's where it is. And then the same thing on the labor market side. Again, like all the headline labor market stuff still looks good. If you look under the hood, there's plenty of reasons to be worried. But to me, until the headline labor market stuff turns, it's demand is going to be strong.
So then the fun thing for me is that if the Fed was actually to give up this kind of forward guidance for cuts, really, and they would say, yeah, you know, we're only going to do a couple, but that's it, really. We don't really feel confident anymore. Then what happens is naturally that the bond market has to reprice pretty aggressively, right? They will have to say, okay, so all these cuts that I have in mind, I need to unwind them. What it probably will do there, it will flatten the curve further. So the front end of the bond market would sell off pretty aggressively. Yields would move higher in 2 and 5 years, maybe down the road in 10s and 30s too, but to a less aggressive extent. So bear flattening basically of the curve. Yields move up, but they do move up, right? So you are already at 4.43 in 30-year rates. You'll probably go to 4.60, 4.70. You know, you'll get to quite high levels of 30-year rates, okay? Yeah. That also means that mortgage rates are going to go even higher, I would expect, right? Because you're pushing higher 30-year treasuries than also 30-year mortgage rates. As a result, they should move higher. And corporate borrowing costs should move higher as well. So you're basically enforcing tightening on the real economy. And we have seen this movie a couple of times already. It hasn't really generated any weakness. But I wonder what happens to risk markets at that point, to equities, for example, because if you keep pushing Brent, right, you have had all these animal spirits in, people have been buying altcoins, Joe Biden, whatever coin, you know, it makes me laugh, but that's what people are doing nowadays. If you push 30-year rates to 4.75, is there a tipping point where people are not so sure anymore whether Joe Biden is a great idea? I mean, what's the deal there?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's not as much about levels. I think it's more about volatility. So if you get more volatility in rates, there will be a point, because I don't think people are ready for that. Like, I think we talked 2 weeks ago when I got back from Brazil, every single person that I talked to was received rates, like calling for lower rates. I don't think that, or lower yields. I don't think that's really the case now. I think it's more balanced, but certainly nobody is really positioned for 10-year yields at 4.75 and a way higher dollar. Like on the FX side, the market's definitely short dollars. So yeah, I think there's definitely a point, and that point will come when you see faster moves in fixed income and you see bond market volatility picking up. And then that kind of relates as well to the BOJ story. So there's been some bond market volatility triggered by their moves in yield curve control, just because all the global bond markets are kind of somewhat linked. But now, so there's two ways of looking at this whole BOJ thing. So first I'll give you my view, and then there's the alternative hypothesis. My view is that it's baby steps. They're going 10 basis points and it's all priced in. And so some evidence of that today, GG, which is like a reputable news service in Japan, said essentially like the BOJ is hiking in March. That's what the headline was.
Pretty much.
And so that would normally be a reason to sell dollar yen to buy yen. And dollar yen went down 40 pips and up 100. So that to me is classic, like, okay, it's priced in. There's no trade in the yen. And if anything, it shows you that it's just meaningless. And it's always going to be 10-year rates in the US that drive dollar yen. And you can move the BOJ policy rate from minus 0.1 to 0. And it's just not going to matter. And that's what we saw in 2016 when they cut it to negative. Dollar yen did not go up, it went down. So that's my view. There is like a fair alternative hypothesis that Abenomics, which started in 2012, which was a government thing, but also a BOJ thing, is kind of like the biggest financial engineering experiment in central bank history. And it was incredibly successful, at least financial markets wise. They took dollar yen from 75 to 150, Nikkei is a four bagger, and wages in Japan are high. The Shunto, which we talked about last week, should confirm today like 5% wage growth in Japan. So they've kind of resuscitated the and eliminated the deflationary story. But now, the even if it's symbolic, you can argue that this rate hike is kind of the end of Abenomics, like the official final end of Abenomics. And now you need organic you know, something organic to take Nikkei from 40 to 50 or WN from 150 to 170. But to me, I don't think that's the right view, but I'm open to that as a possibility because Abenomics was huge.
Yeah. All that's going to matter, I think, Brent, is, as we said, not if they hike in March or April. It doesn't really change much at this point because they are going to hike. The issue is, what's the path forward? Like, is it something sustainable? We talked last time about the forward market in Japan and how much is it pricing for the future years to come in Japan, right? And as I look today at my dashboard here, it says that in a year from now, we're pricing 30 basis points. And in 2 years from now, 50 basis points. 2 years, 50 basis points, guys. I mean, that's like, it's pretty boring, let's be honest. Like, so if this is what they're going to do, and they're going to hike, and then they're going to say, whoa, 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 wait a second, don't get excited. We are going to be very slow. We only want to exit negative interest rates. We're going to buy a bazillion bonds every month anyway, et cetera, et cetera. That's not a very convincing story for a prolonged hawkish move, right? If instead they're going to say, wow, we think things have really changed in Japan. We think the Japan nominal neutral rate is 1.5%, okay? Not very high, but let's say 1 or 1.5%. And we want to get there, okay? We want to build a neutral policy stance in Japan because we think Japan can handle that and we should get there. Okay, that's different because the forward market is pricing 50 basis points for 2 years to go. If it has to go and price 150 basis points, that's a completely different ballgame. So you're raising yields pretty dramatically than domestically, and you can make an argument that you know, Japan versus the euro or Japan versus the Swiss franc or other currencies that are not as high yielding as the dollar, you can make an argument. I mean, if bonds are yielding 2.5% and 10-year Japanese bonds go and yield 2%, you can start making a case, right, for why interest rate differentials matter less. But that requires a prolonged hawkish shift by the Bank of Japan. So that, I think, is what will matter the most. Do they do that? Or do they do a very conservative type of hawkish move?
Right. And I think that's actually a really good framework, is that, you know, the hike for Bank of Japan, essentially, it's going to be March or April. So now who cares about that?
Yeah.
So the real question is, what's the back end, or even like, what are 2 year yields going to do? And that's what people should be watching. I don't think they should be caring that much about specifically, like, does the BOJ go in March or April? Like, that just absolutely doesn't matter. But what matters is the language around the policy, how aggressive they are, confident they are. Do they have PTSD from whenever it was, I think 03, when they hiked and then everything went back to zero? Or are they really confident that Japan is emerging and animal spirits are alive in Japan? Yeah. And if that's the case, then, like you said, 2 year yields are going to move a lot and then it will matter. I agree. So I think it's more about the messaging, the language, and then the subsequent market reaction in further out than it is like whether they hike in March or April. I don't think that matters that much.
You would spend a couple of minutes explaining to people why, before you said that, and now we're still talking about the rate of change being the most important thing than the levels that we reach, right? Now we're saying if the rate of change in bond yields in Japan is very rapid, then we expect this to matter a lot. And we also said something similar before. So please try to explain, Brent, why from a market perspective, rate of change matters more than the levels.
Sure. So that is the case in a lot of things. Like, you'll see the same thing in equities. If equities are going down slowly, like they drop 0.4% 4 days in a row, then the reaction function in everything else and the correlations will be pretty low. But if equities drop 3% in one day, then you'll see correlations pick up significantly. So generally, I think it's because everyone is kind of set up for specific levels of volatility in terms of their portfolios. And then when volatility goes above what you expected, you have to change your behavior and then you have to reevaluate what future volatility is going to be. So if stocks drop 0.5% and you're long, you go, okay, whatever, I don't care. But if they drop 3%, even if you're nowhere close to your drawdown, then you have to start thinking, okay, well, the fact that they dropped 3% today, even though we haven't seen a 3% move in whatever, say 3 months, means the probability of a 3% drop tomorrow is now higher because volatility clusters. So then people have to change their behaviors. And so generally, I always feel like there's three things, right? There's levels, there's changes. Well, you can go infinite into the derivatives, but there's levels, there's changes, and then there's the rate of change. And to me, I mean, especially as a more short-term person, it's always about changes and rates of change, and levels just don't matter that much. So that's, I'm always looking at what's the speed of the move and how much have things moved, you know, over the last little bit. And generally, I don't think levels are that important, other than sometimes you'll see a psychological element of like oil above 100 could create some kind of nonlinear response function where people just get more scared about inflation when oil's above 100 or something like that. But generally, it's almost always going to be level, changes, and then the speed of those changes that that influences, especially if you're looking at cross market stuff. Like if I'm looking at what are yields doing because I'm trading dollar yen, then I'm really concerned about the change in yields and the speed of the change in yields, and much less about just the levels of the yields.
Golden nuggets here. I mean, this is really important because people who have traded at an institutional level, like you or I, know that at the end of the day, it's all about vol and value at risk. And this is how your risk limits are set, right? So if volatility is accelerating all of a sudden, then it will force you to take some actions, literally force you sometimes to take actions. And also other people will have to change their behavior accordingly. So that's why the rate of change really matters, because it generates a cascade of actions, basically, and portfolio degrossing and people being forced to do stuff. In the hedge fund industry, for example, everybody runs very, very tight risk limits. So if the rate of change is very fast, there is a higher chance that a lot of hedge fund guys have to do something reacting to that event.
Right. They have to de-risk because of the volatility. And in 2022, it was actually really interesting that you could see that the dollar was reacting to bond market volatility a lot more than actual changes in yields, which is kind of interesting. So if yields went up fast, the dollar ripped. But if yields went up a little bit for three straight days, sometimes a dollar would go down in that 3-day period. Yeah. So it was only actually the speed of, or you could look at like move or move index or whatever, but it was more about bond market volatility than the actual change in yields, which was interesting.
Yeah, agreed. So as always, to finish the podcast, the two favorite sessions from people listening, which is first the trade ideas. What are we going to do there?
So for me right now, I'm long euro sterling. It's one of those trades where there's nothing like super sexy about it, but everything lines up that I look at. So like macro, technicals, positioning, cross-market correlation, everything lines up. And it's one of those where it's not, there's not one single thing screaming like it has to go higher. But the main driver for me is interest rate differentials with euro sterling, which have been pointing quite a bit higher. And then you have positioning for some reason, which I don't understand. I've been trying to figure this out for the past few weeks, but the market's been putting on a really big long cable position, a long sterling position. And I can't explain why, but anyways, that's happening. So yeah. And then the market's been short euros as it often is. So I think it's an interesting setup from a positioning point of view. And then if you look at a chart, we've essentially been bouncing off of 85.00 since, if you go all the way back to July of last year, we haven't been able to take out 85.00. And for me, the best trades are, you know, there's always a tension between having a tight stop and having a too, like an overly tight stop, so you get stopped out too easily. But the best trades for me are ones that have a fairly tight stop, because then you can have more leverage. So in this case, you know, euro sterling's at 85.50. Your stop can be down below 85, the figure, which is pretty tight. It's a little bit boring, but I think it's going to work. And it's a kind of thing you can risk 60 to make 140 pips or something like that. And just to be clear, everything we say on here is not investment advice, and I could change my mind at any point.
Yes, please. Do your own due diligence. We are going to lose money. Please don't lose money with us. Sometimes we're also going to make money. I mean, it happens, you know. Then what about me? So I think I am still very happy running these dollar longs positions. I like this expression versus Brazil that I talked about, because I think if this carry trade starts unwinding, then it could go pretty sour pretty quick. But also dollar Sweden, for example, or dollar New Zealand are type of ideas that I think just make sense, because honestly, it's not a negative carry trade. It's actually positive carry against Sweden, for example. And all that it needs that the Federal Reserve to endorse is hawkishness. And then honestly, Sweden can't keep up with the Federal Reserve. If the Fed decides to go higher for longer, it's going to be very hard for certain vulnerable countries to follow through. So it naturally, I think, would strengthen the dollar. And then long time held position, which is short Swiss and long Japanese yen. Because I think the yield differentials there matter way less. So the actions of the Bank of Japan are magnified in this pair compared to, for example, dollar Japan. Ultimately, though, the fancy trade that I'm looking to put on, I've resisted the urge so far for a lot of time, is to be short equities, because I think the animal spirits have built up pretty aggressively. Been saying that for a bit, and luckily for me, I'm not pulling the trigger to go short, which means I haven't been stopped out yet trying. But I think that if the Federal Reserve turns, that could reignite that volatility in bond markets that ultimately feeds into volatility in the stock market as well. So all eyes on the Fed, and then I'll, of course, not let you know timely if I pull the trigger, but at least you know what my potential playbook was up there.
And I think if the dots change next week, I think there's probably room for surprise there, because I think most people that I talk to really were focused on June for the dots to change. Yeah. So if the dots were to change this next week, and just a quick mention on your Swiss yen trade, the Swiss National Bank meets next week as well, and they're priced for like 35% chance of a cut. And I think there's a decent chance they actually cut.
Yeah, because they're a very orthodox type of central bank. If they made up their mind they should cut, they're not going to wait for the Fed. I mean, Switzerland can be pretty much convincingly orthodox, a bit like the Norges Bank, for example, or even the Bank of New Zealand to a certain extent. Anyway, Brent, what's the worst thing that you heard or read this week?
So I'm trying to find the stupidest thing, and I always find that the stupidest thing is also kind of a genius thing at the same time. So I don't know if this is stupid or genius, but the fun thing about financial Twitter or FinTwit is there's a new character, there's a new main character all the time. It's Bill Ackman a lot of the times, or Elon Musk. But this week there's this guy who's like 23 years old, or maybe 42 years old, I don't know. But this man named Nick O'Neill, aka NFT Nick, and he posted this flex video showing himself on a yacht. And then people noticed he had left the waiver clipboard on the deck of the boat. So it was obviously a rental. So then he doubles down and he posts a link from this rented apartment that he lives in, saying he's holding a $5,000 bottle of wine or of champagne, but it's obviously Tattinger, which is like $80. So then he pivots again to an obviously fake video. He's driving a Mazda and he's saying, "Yo, I'm in my Lambo. What's up?" And like, it's obviously not a Lamborghini from, he's just filming it himself. So now, kind of like the entire NFT and altcoin world, nobody knows if this is parody or it's marketing genius or it's like straight up delusional flexing. It's like this 4D chess he's playing, or it's just complete insanity. I don't know, but whatever. It's the stupidest and the most interesting thing that was on financial markets this week.
We can tell you it's definitely stupid. I'm not going to express myself on the 4D chess game. It's stupid for sure. The best thing I read this week is I reread the first chapter of a book of somebody I'm blessed to call a friend, which is Steve Drobny. He wrote Inside the House of Money a while ago, which you should absolutely read. It's a masterpiece where he interviews the best hedge fund managers he could find back then. And he asks them about their process, their risk management. Amazing book, Inside the House of Money. And I reread the first chapter, and that's the best thing I've read this week. And the first chapter, actually, he interviews another friend of mine, Jim Leitner. Hey, Jim, if you're listening, hi. And you should take a look at that chapter. It's really good. In reality, the whole book is really good. When he interviews Jamie May, which was also in one of these movies, you could also see how these people think and how they structure trades and what's their risk management. And it's really awesome. So have a look at that.
Yeah, it's a great book. Actually, one thing I wanted to mention too, right before we cut, is Spectra School is about to go live. And so people can sign up for the waitlist now at spectramarkets.com/school. So if anyone is interested, just go there and sign up. It's free, free to sign up for the waitlist, and people on the waitlist will get sweet deals.
Oh, he just dropped a bomb. So Spectra School is a very cool thing. Eh? Brent is trying to expand on his educational arm. And if you read his newsletter, which you should, you know that Brent is very big at teaching, and Spectra School sounds very exciting. So we'll do something. We'll put the link in the show notes of the podcast. So stop being lazy. Just take the phone, please, and scroll to this podcast and the description. There will be a link. You click on it. And then how does it work, Brent? They go into a wait list. Like, it's free. There is no commitment, no anything.
Yep, that's right. And then we'll probably be ready to launch in about a month.
Oh, that's awesome. Let's all do that. Stop being lazy. Go to click on the link that we'll put at the end of the podcast. And I think that was it for the week. We'll talk next week, but this time seriously with a bold guest, which is not my co-host Brent, but a bold guest, I promised. Brent is on holiday, right? Somewhere in Canada.
Yeah, I'm going to Canada.
cool because you don't need to watch this, the Fed, right? It doesn't matter. Who cares?
Yeah, well, sometimes you got to leave.
Yeah, it's fair enough, man. We love you all. Thanks for listening. We'll talk all next right. week.
Thanks, Alf.
The content provided on the Macro Trading Floor podcast is for general information purposes only. No information or other content provided in this podcast should be considered as investment advice. Seek independent professional consultation in the form of legal, financial, and fiscal advice before making any investment decision. Always perform your own due diligence.